Okay, so I'm going to talk about quantum turbulence and try to define what that is, at least what I mean when I say that. Reconnection of quantized vortices and quantum fixed points, by which in particular I mean fixed points of the Gross-Pitiyevsky equation, which is a reasonable set of equations for the evolution of a quantum fluid. So I should say that I've been blessed with a very talented team of people to work with, one of which is here. So it's a Christy is here, actually. And I guess the data that I'm going to show today is a combination of things that Greg Bewley discovered, measurements from Matt Paletti's dissertation work, some ring collapse analysis that Caitlin Tooley did, and I guess in particular then, David Mikeley in the far lower corner. The quantum fixed points have been his numerical work under the supervision of Michael Fisher and I. Okay, in any case. And I should credit the National Science Foundation for their generous support. Now, you all know likely that I'm an experimentalist, and I got started in the study of superfluidity somewhat by a historical accident of Greg Bewley being Srinivasan's last Yale graduate student who landed in my lab when Srini went to Trieste. So that history then presented me with a superfluid experiment somewhat unbidden in my lab, but really fascinating things we saw. So one of the things that I will try to explain to you is what this movie is and what it means. So what you're seeing are hydrogen ice particles that have been illuminated by a laser sheet traversing from side to side, 100 microns thick. This is about 8 millimeters high by 8 millimeters wide, and you're just viewing it from the side with a high-speed CCD camera. And these particles then are under the influence of a turbulent tangle of quantized vortices that's relaxing, okay? And we will look in more detail about what this is as we go along. Now, I put on the wiki for this conference some suggested possible definitions that people could debate or discuss or I don't know, I guess we already have one acceptance, is what I've heard. But so by turbulence, I mean a spatially extended field with a large continuous range of aperiodic spatial and temporal dynamics. And so you'll notice in particular that doesn't refer to a fluid. And so then one might accept that you can have turbulent optical fields or turbulent chemically reacting fields, or there could be a wide variety of turbulence that one might consider. Now I'm going to talk about...
So you didn't consider cascade as being fundamental?
Well, in as much as a cascade is not an observable, it's a conceptual item that maybe can be teased out of numerics, I hesitate to put that directly in the definition. Whereas a large range of length scales or a large range of time scales is something that can be directly observed in many cases in an unambiguous way. Now, maybe those imply a cascade in many or most, but not all, possibilities. But yeah. So by quantum turbulence, what I mean is a turbulent complex field or an interacting set of complex fields. And we think of superfluidity and helium 4 as having an underlying order parameter, which is a complex field.
Yeah. How is your definition of turbulence different from a critical point, a dynamic critical point?
Well, that's an excellent question, Nigel. I guess that I somehow presume when we talk about turbulence that we are out of equilibrium.
You may adopt my definition that there are many degrees of freedom are deviated far from equilibrium.
Yeah. Every so maybe non-equilibrium is an important part of what we mean by turbulence. Right. Yeah. I'll take that as a friendly amendment, Nigel. Would that suffice though?
Then the question
to modify it that way?
I don't want to hijack your seminar.
So of course I'm going to be focusing on this case and talking in particular quite a bit about the dynamics of complex fields, although I guess we've already seen that these occur in other situations beyond quantum fluids as well. And then I put on the website some definitions not so much having to do with this talk.
That
about.
Complex is not a complexity, it's a real complex. It's real and imaginary part.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
complex.
Right. There being a magnitude and phase, for instance.
Any wave turbulence is described by complex field.
That's right.
Amplitude phase.
That's right.
Good point.
Okay.
Pattern-forming systems where you have wave dynamics with envelope equations are often naturally described by a complex field and probably show many of the features, but I'll touch on that since Everhard's been spamming me with references in the last 24 hours.
He's covered it. It's his fault.
Yeah, roommates are a useful thing. So quantum fluid is a state of matter, much like you think of solids or gases as a state of matter, but in particular having long-range quantum order. And I tend to think of this as a type of synchronization. If we think of the helium atoms, let's say, as each being a little oscillator, a local oscillator, so the state of superfluidity is where there is a partial synchronization then of the wave functions of the helium. They're not completely synchronized, but there's a certain phase synchrony which extends throughout the apparatus. Now, the fact we're not at zero T means there's also phase jitter, so there's still some thermal component. Yes, please.
With synchronization, you mean synchronization in, like, in oscillators?
Absolutely.
And where are this then the dissipation?
Well, if I drive the system from equilibrium, it returns to equilibrium by some process which is not entirely understood. But there is dissipation in the system.
It's not there. It is there, but.
Yes, I've not observed any part of nature that doesn't have some dissipative channels. I don't always know what they are, but okay. They're.
I thought in this quantum world there is no dissipation.
You can think of idealized models, and when I work in Grospetyevsky, then that actually is a Hamiltonian system, which taken as a whole doesn't have dissipative processes.
Okay.
But perhaps you can exchange energy between the wave field and the vortices.
Okay,
so of course there are examples of this. So I'm going to be talking about helium-4, but BC atomic systems, helium-3, superconductors, and the vacuum itself is thought to possess any number of relativistic quantum fluids associated with the Higgs fields. So quantum turbulence then is just really turbulence in a quantum fluid. And one might think that this could matter if you would like to understand the far from equilibrium dynamics of any of these systems, including the vacuum. So we're going to be looking at a particular system, helium-4, which is one of the earliest known of these quantum fluids, but I would say not the best understood. In fact, the BEC systems are much better understood due to the theory being much better developed since they're weakly interacting, where helium-4 in this state is strongly interacting, making the analysis hard, I understand. So in the pressure-temperature plane, then, we do experiments along the coexistence curve between the gas and liquid. And as we cool, then, our liquid with a free surface down through this lambda point, or it's actually a whole line of lambda points, we go into a state with long-range quantum order, which has both still some thermal component, but some component which is able to flow without resistance. And of course, this lambda point is named after the fact that the specific heat diverges as you pass through this phase transition. Now, the two-fluid model of TESA and it separately Landau is a useful context for thinking about this, although one might have some doubts as to whether this is base physics or just a phenomenological way of thinking about things. The two-fluid model says that there's a order parameter which describes, in a natural way, this synchronized state. So it has an amplitude, the amplitude of the synchronization, and a phase, telling you the phase around which things are synchronized. But that can depend on space. So this is a spatially, eventually spatially disordered field. So the two-fluid model says beyond this, there's also a normal component that you might think of as a normal fluid, which can give rise then to dissipative effects. But can be thought of as that part which is not synchronized as well. Although the superfluid component becomes all of the fluid at zero temperature, whereas this disordered component falls rapidly. The experiments we do tend to be around this range, so having still some substantial normal component, but through to having some substantial superfluid component, but always with some of those there. Now, an important aspect of this model, in particular the order parameter, is because of the form of the quantum mechanical flux, right, which is psi star grad psi minus psi grad psi star, the superfluid velocity associated with this order parameter is given or proportional to the gradient of the phase of the order parameter, the proportionality constant being Planck's constant divided by the mass of the helium atom. And this actually works very well. It has significant predictive power, and I don't think anybody's ever found any problems with this model as being a good descriptor of what happens.
It's independent on the amplitude A.
So the amplitude A is likely very, very flat and is associated then with this density almost everywhere, except around the vortices.
But the perfect velocity is independent on this density the way you defined it, right?
So I guess really you need to define the momentum, and then that would also have a psi star psi out front. And so then this is sort of an expression assuming that the density is flat. Okay. Which is probably, as long as you're not within 5 angstrom of a vortex, this probably works very well. So this order parameter is depleted at the vortex core. Oh, I didn't even mention vortices. Okay, vortices. So vortices are a strong topological defect in this order parameter. It's just a phase winding. And in particular, if you have a 2 pi phase winding around some line, then the velocity circulates this, and it really is associated with a little quantum tornado. And moreover, since the superfluid velocity is proportional to the gradient of the phase, if the vorticity, the curl of that is almost everywhere is zero, and so all the vorticity is concentrated on these line-like vortices. So very much unlike a Newtonian fluid where the vorticity is a smooth function distributed and then diffused, the vorticity here doesn't diffuse. It's topologically confined to these lines, which then are mobile, interact, but form a sort of skeleton of the motion up to boundary conditions. Okay, so again, real physical apparatus, real physical fussy apparatus, I guess, which is, I've come to understand that doing low temperature physics is very hard relative to many other types of physics, and there are many things that have to cooperate all at once in a very a way that requires lots of finesse. Is that a fair characterization, Christy?
Yes.
So the fluid is actually in a small volume in the center here, the working volume. There are windows on this cryostat. There are actually 5 windows, 2 in the x direction, 2 in the y direction, and a z view from below. So again, we pass a laser sheet through one pair of those windows, look in the side, and put particles in. And so it's very much like traditional diagnostics in fluid dynamics that you look at particle motions in order to understand the flow. Although we're not doing particle image velocimetry, we will do a lot of particle tracking, which is actually much more useful and appropriate for this particular state. Okay, so Greg Bewley's great invention was that he could produce particles in situ right before the experiment. And he did this because of necessity, the mother of all invention. He couldn't find particles that were suitable for tracking helium because of its low density. And so lacking being able to buy particles, eventually Greg invented particles. And he did so by producing hydrogen ice particles. So inject hydrogen gas heavily diluted by helium, and the dilution is the important key. Otherwise, you just fill your cryostat with snowflakes. And as pretty as that might be, it's not scientifically very useful. But the dilution produces very small particles. So here, we're going to inject above transition. Here you can see, this is really densities of this fog of particles. Individual particles are micron or submicron particles. When you first inject, of course, they're not yet mixed. Okay, so very nice field of particles that can be used for standard flow visualization.
What is the typical ratio of the of helium to hydrogen?
Ah, I think that's an upcoming slide exactly shows this.
You found it in the equation.
Not in the experiment or in the gas?
In the gas.
Oh, 100 to 1, 100
to 1.
500 to 1,
yeah.
10,000 to 1 works.
In his, they were mostly 50 to 1.
50 to 1, right. Although 1 to 1 is bad.
Yeah.
Right. And so, Gunter, you may have known that a number of people tried this some decades ago without dilution. And discovered cryostat filled with snow is easy to achieve. Okay, now Greg did a series of experiments then characterizing turbulence above transition where we just have normal helium. And then a number of our colleagues all urged us to go down below the transition and see what happens. So Joe Vinen, Joe Niemla, Russ Donnelly, a number of people said, well, you got it working, cool it, just do it. Okay, so eventually one night Greg cooled it, and what he found was that the particles become trapped by, and thereby allow you to visualize, the location and motions of the quantized vortices. Now, this particular movie is an early one with lots of hydrogen. So in fact, this has a number of curious features which are due to the hydrogen more than the helium in part. But you can see all these filament-like structures appear and move about.
And they don't have to be vortex filaments at this stage.
No, this is down below transition, so yes.
I know, but what we're seeing might not be vortex filaments because of what you just mentioned. The hydrogen has...
I mean, they could just be cobwebs.
Right.
But why would hydrogen want to form into cobweb-like shapes in the system would have to be explained by some other means. Okay, now, this is somewhat hard to see. If we just go down right below transition, you start to see bundles of filaments. Okay, is that... You can see it a little bit, I suppose. these dotted lines occur.
You share one lens surface, so it just move out surface, or?
We're only illuminating 100 micron thick sheet.
Okay, sheet, okay.
Which is then, let's say, 8 millimeters by 8 millimeters.
Okay.
And actually we do that because the lens on our system has a depth of field about that, okay. And so we try not to illuminate the portion that's out of focus. That just gives you a lot of stray light. So in any case, by a number of different means, we established that these particles do get trapped by the vortices and allow us to see them. Now, the mechanism by which this happens has been... Yes, please.
We do know that this is not complex, because you only see these vortices below the superfluid.
That's right.
Right. So
and they go away as you go above it.
So it can't be anything. It can't be complex.
I'll say that in jest.
They can.
I'm sorry.
They can be. Okay, you could start with a
joking flag.
You could start with two hydrogen things that maybe have been attracted into a quantum vortex. But then you can have dendritic crystal growth away from that suddenly, quickly. Once you have something started, it could nucleate and create dendritic crystal growth.
But let me say that.
And you could be seeing that.
Almost all the experiments we've done have been in the limit where the particles are disconnected and not forming the
right. Some of the initial things.
I think there's still a slide about that coming up to finally answer.
I agree that what he's going to be showing you isn't cobwebs, right. But some of their initial results really did look like cobwebs.
Oh yes, they often look like cobwebs, especially at high mass fraction.
And very well.
Now the mechanism has been known since 1966, the Parks and Donnelly paper, which was then used by Packard's group to do visualization with ions. But the basic mechanism is the same. If I park a particle on this vortex, which has a very rapid circulation close to the core, I'm avoiding kinetic energy by doing so. And so then there's a kinetic energy or a potential minimum to do that. That's one way to describe it. Another way to describe it is that there is a pressure field associated with the circulation, which has a minimum, and so then the pressure gradient sucks the particles in. Now that doesn't happen in a normal fluid in the same way. In a normal fluid, if I have a vortex, then there is this pressure gradient, but the particle also circulates, so it has a centrifugal force, which is balanced by the pressure gradient, depending on the particle's density. If the particle is light, a bubble, it gets pulled into the vortex. If the particle is heavy, it gets expelled from the vortex. Centrifuges work basically on this principle. Now in our case, the particles don't orbit the vortex because the motion is ideal and slips around the particles. So the particles are not dragged to orbit. So they have the pressure gradient without the centrifugal part. So all particles, independent of density, get sucked into the vortices. And we've verified that by trying different gases other than hydrogen. Hydrogen is a little bit light, but I guess argon, I think, was tried. Atmospheric gas works fine. Actually, you can use nitrogen particles, which are heavy compared to helium for sure, and they get sucked in as well.
Quick question.
Yeah.
In the movie that we saw the motions, is that the real speed? Give us real sense of speed?
Yes, those are real time.
Okay, it's pretty slow, right? It's not very fast.
Depending on state. Right. So there are some, yes. Okay. I mean, we have a limit to the frame rate of our camera, so we try to prepare states where we can see.
That's the real time. Okay.
I think every movie I show you will be in real time.
Okay.
Right. And you can see these with your naked eye, actually, for what it's worth. you got to get close focus. But okay, so now here is what happens with increased mass fraction in the liquid itself. So if you load the system with a lot of hydrogen, then the vortices tend to become skeletonized. You have continuous cobwebs, if you will, and branches are stabilized in the vortices that otherwise wouldn't necessarily be stable. Now, yeah, please.
This was used by some people to make nanowires.
Yeah, gold nanowires have been built by this technique just last year, actually, in superfluid helium, right.
What is the size of the picture, the length?
Again, these will all be about a centimeter by a centimeter, right. So, real time, but blown up a little bit. Okay, if we go to a lower mass fraction, we tend to have the particles trapped on the vortices and tend to see a uniform spacing of particles along the vortices in a way that we don't understand why that occurs, but it's a fairly robust phenomenon.
We'll control the spacing.
It appears to be uniform and somewhat reproducible from experiment to experiment.
Does it depend on the size of the particles?
I didn't answer your question. I don't have an answer to your question.
Does it depend on the size of the particles?
No.
So it depends on the size of particles, the space of the
same. And temperature, and velocities in the system. Okay, so Michael Fisher at least commented, well, it implies short-range repulsion and long-range attraction. And Woolery said that's no big surprise because to not have that requires fine-tuning, perhaps. Well, at least one of the two, I mean, so. Okay, but so some theory is probably needed for why we have uniform spacing. So mass fraction increases that way. History of the experiments increases this way. We tend to do experiments in a very dilute limit in order to mostly be studying the helium and not effects due to them having a lot of hydrogen particles involved in the flow overall. Okay, so
when the density is low, you have no trapping. You have no trapping of particles.
The trapping mechanism doesn't depend on how much hydrogen you have around. Even a single particle that finds itself near a vortex will become trapped. Okay, although it's a well of finite depth, so particles actually can become trapped, untrapped, and scatter. And the theory of that is not yet developed either. Actually, we see scattering events, which are pretty unambiguous as well. So vortex coming along, particle here, the vortex passes, the particle, you know, gets disturbed but not trapped. Especially near transition, actually, the well depth of the vortex goes to zero. Okay, so I want to drive the system away from equilibrium in order to generate lots of vortices. One of the ways we can do that in a superfluid is to put heat at the bottom. So this is analogous to Rayleigh-Bernard, but not. So with heat at the bottom, we generally are evaporatively cooling at the top. In the case of a superfluid, heat is carried ballistically rather than convectively. So the superfluid component moves downward to the heater. In some sense, you can think of it as being converted into excitations. The excitations flow upward, which we denote by this normal fluid. And these two interpenetrate. So in the context of the two-fluid model, then, thermal counterflow is an interpenetrating flow of a component that carries entropy, the normal component, and a component that does not carry entropy that are being exchanged at the heater. Now, Joe Bynum developed a phenomenological theory for how vortices are created in such a counterflow, and it's very much like dynamo action. A piece of vortex has friction with the normal component, becomes stretched out and twisted, and you generate line length via the interaction of these two components. And when the heater's on, you tend to be growing a big tangle of vortices. I've shown a cartoon here. After you turn the heaters off, it tends to decay. And so then in the Bynum model, there's a growth term and a decay term for the vortex line length per unit volume. So awkwardly, capital L has the units of 1 over length squared, since it's a quantity. OK, so let me show you what that looks like in the experiment. So here, I've just turned on a heater below. And what you see is that there's some collection of particles that are moving upward relatively uniformly. So we interpret these to be particles not trapped on quantized vortices and being dragged by Stokes drag with the normal component. You see another collection of particles that are moving in an erratic way downward, and we interpret those as being trapped on this evolving tangle of vortices. And of course, at this low dilution limit, you don't see the vortices directly. You only have lots of hydrogen to do that, but then you're disturbing the system in a more significant way. But at least let me point out that this is a direct visual confirmation of the two-fluid model, that there are clearly two different types of motions that are at play here. And that in itself is useful, although you can actually quantify quite a few things by analyzing those movies, which I will not go through here.
But it's not exactly. I mean, what you're seeing is VT, not VS.
But VN is directly what we see.
VN, yes.
So VN is a function of
two fluid model involves VN and VS.
Right. That's right.
It doesn't know anything about VT.
Right. So, but part one of the results from Landau in the two fluid model was that VN is linear with the heat flux, with the proportionality constant being the entropy per unit mass.
No, we
verified that.
I have no problem with the particles going up, but questioning whether the particles going down have anything to do with VS.
Well, so it's true that they are not moving with VS. They're trapped on the vortices. The vortices are executing a motion which is a combination of advection with VS and this mutual pressure. Right.
But they clearly go down.
Yes, in an erratic way. Right. And with less than the mean of VS you would expect from the two-fluid model, and more or less required by conservation of mass, given what VN is. Okay, now we wanted to look at quantum turbulence without the heater being on, and what we found is that we could recreate a reproducible state of tangle and watch it decay by turning on the heater for a few seconds and then turning it off rapidly, and then here we've just integrated the Vinon model. The line length grows, and then the line length decays. And then you could just do this over and over again, and you could just watch the decay and try to understand what it's doing. So here's heater on, heater off. Now look at those particle motions. Everhard, look at the particle motions. All right, I got it. All right, let's try this one more time here. Cooperate with me. There we go. Okay, now watch right when the heater turns off now. Have you ever seen particles move like that in a normal fluid? It's a little odd, right? Much higher velocities, much larger accelerations than what I've seen in the sort of turbulent flows that I've looked at. So I think I'm going to skip through this, but get to, in particular, these very...
Well, what do you mean?
Let me go back to just show
you. There are some pairs moving kind
of... So right when we turn it off, look at this motion that the particles are executing here.
Small-scale, fast motion.
Exactly, with high velocities and high accelerations. Right.
Yeah.
They're very agitated, right?
Yeah. Go.
Okay.
You know where you go.
The reason for this motion is connected with the process of the reconnection of vortices. So this is something that was predicted by Feynman in 1955. Basically, the idea was that a vortex could approach itself, and what he said here is that if this process is allowed from B to C, then you could reduce the line length, and it in fact allows an approach to equilibrium. You can imagine a model where reconnection was not allowed, right? Things couldn't, or even were forbidden from crossing, and you could actually easily get into a knot that you could not untie. So reconnection is useful for dissipation, but also involves very high velocities in an interesting way. Okay, now, vortex reconnection has been studied a number of different ways, and I'll come back to some of the theory in a minute, but the basic idea is this. Two line-like vortices cross, exchange tails, form something like hyperbole, and then retract. It's important to realize that the vortices have a line tension, something like an energy per unit length. So it'd be as if you stretched out two rubber bands, glued them together, and then snipped them diagonally, right? They're gonna retract somewhat violently depending on this line tension. Now, we don't see the vortices themselves. We see particles trapped on the vortices, but without the core. So what one might think is you could see something like this, okay? So let me show you our first observation of that process. So look right there. Oh, okay, I think it's going to jog back and forth through it. So right in here, so these two dotted lines approach each other, exchange tails, and then rapidly retract. Okay, I know this is a little gratuitous, but we're kind of fond of this movie.
They're in the plane. They retract in the plane.
Well, we only see particles in the plane because we're illuminating a thin sheet.
Not particles in the plane.
This is really a 3D experiment where we're visualizing a slice.
I would have thought that at the point where they're bending very heavily, you know, there's a lot of velocity on the binomial.
Yes.
Or the plane.
Yes. Right. Which we're not yet capturing with this particular diagnostic. Right, so we're seeing all this in projection. So it just keeps going and going and going. We're very excited when we saw this.
One can meditate looking for all of this.
But in fact, we've been looking for this for a long time, but we weren't quite sure what to look for. But it turns out these very high velocities and accelerations are just that. Okay, now, one of the things that theory... Okay. down movie. One of the things that the theory had predicted is that the separation, delta, should behave in a particular way. If kappa, the quantum of circulation, is the only relevant parameter in the system, then the separations would have to go like kappa to the 1/2 time to the 1/2. And the theory's actually held that this should be true from the approach to reconnection and retraction from reconnection. Okay, so this is something that we wanted to go forward and look at directly in the experiments. So we do particle tracking, billions of particles, just get their coordinates as a function of time. And we look for pairs that are rapidly approaching or rapidly separating. And we just search through all possible pairs to do that with a particular criteria that detects ones that are approach close or start close and go wide apart. So here this inset shows delta, the separation as a function of time and log coordinates. And you can see that we do see actually many tens of thousands of sorts of events of power-like approach or retraction and really equal numbers of both types. Now we fit this to a model which basically has the square root and time dependence. It's all very event-to-event fluctuations, so Michael Fisher suggested we put on a next correction, a subleading exponent. And so then for each pair that we find that does this, we fit this model and then show the probability distribution of the different A's and C's that we observe over about 20,000 approaching events and 20,000 retracting events from this decaying turbulent state. So you can see A has a nice distribution with a single peak near 1, which actually suggests both that kappa is the controlling parameter, this quantum circulation, and because there are no evident subpeaks, that we're not seeing reconnection events between higher order n vortices, but these are n equal 1 vortices interacting with n equal 1 vortices. Okay, and I guess the C term does something very boring. It turns out that correction term is small compared to 1 in almost all cases, so it's really not the significant thing. The other thing is that you might notice these probability distributions between the red and the black curves, the pre and post reconnection are almost the same, which indicates that we have a statistical time reversal invariance of these events, which is a little bit odd considering we still have dissipative mechanisms in place. They're just not at play around locally at the time of these events. So even though we do go back to equilibrium, it's not in the middle of these events that it seems like that's the main process.
What is the temperature when this all occurs?
These experiments were around 2K.
2K.
Yeah, which is around the 50-50 point between normal and superfluid. So there still should be significant dissipative channels available. I want to talk a little bit about some theoretical aspects of reconnection, which have occupied a number of people's thinking the last few years. So some of the early numerical calculations were done by Klaus Schwarz using the local induction approximation. So he was able then to capture this mechanism post-reconnection of this retraction of the vortices due to their line tension. Now, local induction approximation is just a sort of first attempt to understand the dynamics based on the local curvature causing self-advection. Later models, that was 85, 94, DeVale and Arts did a calculation using a Biot-Savart formulation where you integrate the contributions all along the vortex on other parts of the vortex with a small length scale cutoff necessary in Biot-Savart. And they studied the reconnection process and found that the reconnected vortices, actually the approach to reconnection in these vortices forms a pyramid. And they speculated in the paper that the angles of this pyramid might be something that occur in all reconnection events. And so then for a long time people were thinking, well, maybe there's one type of reconnection that occurs in the superfluid. Okay, well, although there was one simulation they did, so it's far from certain. Now, since then, I guess we had two papers come out this past year. Bob Kerr's work that he already commented on, where he had two anti-parallel vortices that reconnected and gave rings. There's also a paper by Tabzione and Brangi, also recent, where they looked at the separation delta as a function of time and very directly compared then the scalings with these functional forms between the theory and experiments and found good agreement. In each of these cases then, these models are more sophisticated than Biot-Savart or local induction and are using a three-dimensional simulation of Gross-Pitievsky, which I guess has been known since Koplik and Levine that Gross-Pitievsky's can allows reconnection naturally just through the imaginary diffusion that the Schrodinger equation allows you to pass through reconnection without any extra mechanisms, that these line vortex models always have to have some sort of ad hoc surgery otherwise, because in the context of the model itself, reconnection's precluded, not admitted. Mm-hmm. It's reconnection by subroutine, I guess, for these line vortex models otherwise.
Discretize the Gauss equation, allow the discretion.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, but I think that theoretically it's allowed if you show it in different ways. So it's not just the numerical discretizations that allow it.
Then by singularity. Yes.
No. It's a completely smooth process.
Okay.
It's a completely smooth process. Yeah, so Nazarenko and West have, at a linear and first-order correction, an analytical model for reconnection out of Gross-Pitievsky in it. If there's no singularity, even though the square root is involved, because it's really kind of a scissor effect.
Okay.
So the vortices are zeros of the complex field. So if you think about the real and imaginary parts of both need to be zero, a simplest model is to have zeros for the real field be a saddle, and the zeros for the imaginary field be a plane, and then just have that plane pass through the saddle, and the vortices approach each other, form a cross, and retract. And the velocities are large, but again, it's a scissor effect. These fields are all moving.
Nothing physical moves with infinite speed.
Thank you. Yeah. And in fact, we have to have some cutoff in our experiments with regard to the square root business. It's at best intermediate asymptotic. Likely cut off by the speed of sound, but okay. Now,
so is the distance in the Gross-Vitalski equation behaves like the square root of time?
Yes. In fact, that Berengi result I just showed verified that from the Gross-Vitalski simulations. They actually checked both the square root and the correction factor. Both seem to.
It's a statement from geometry of caustics closed.
Yeah. Close. In fact, the Snazarenko and West paper at the linear order calculate the square root already. So it's well understood analytically how that occurs in a smooth way. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit more about the Gross-Vitalski equations, just because I really love nonlinear partial differential equations and find myself studying them without a license, I guess, too much.
You're welcome.
So, you know, okay, it's a fault. So Michael Fisher, over the phone to me one night, suggested that perhaps there was a fixed point of the Gross-Vitalski equations that could be associated with the reconnection process. And over about 24 hours, I managed to convince myself not only could there be, there must be. And I found the form at linear order which solved that, which actually was a special case of what Nazarenko and West already found, but they didn't remark as that there was a fixed point in their broader scope of dynamics. But then David Michley took this idea and actually found the nonlinear extension of it as a solution to Gross-Vitalski altogether. So let me actually talk about fixed points in a broader context. So the simplest fixed point is just the flat solution. So everything's flat and up to a phase, then stationary. Okay, so that's the base state. A long straight vortex is a fixed point, so infinitely long. It has a radial profile and a single 2 pi winding around it. So actually, you can have a higher order winding. So here's, let's say, an n equal 2 vortex, long straight vortex would also be a fixed point of the model. And one can compute those. At least you can compute f of r numerically for all those cases. Now, the fixed point we're talking about then has a particular reconnection geometry, which is not this. It's not a vortex going in and going out and one coming up and going out. It's actually four half vortices, two pointed in and two pointed out, coplanar at 90 degrees. And all of those are necessary conditions from a symmetry perspective for it to be stationary. Now you can see, I think, why waylight might be frustrated, and it's a saddle fixed point. It could reconnect like this into the first and third quadrants, or it could reconnect into the second, fourth quadrants, and it doesn't know which if it's balanced there. Okay, so it's stuck in that state. Okay, now, David Michley wrote a sequence of codes and established this was numerically a nonlinear fixed point. So this is done in a cube with grad cycle zero boundary conditions. And he actually used an interesting numerical trick to find the fixed point. If you have a fixed point of the Gross-Vitalski equations, it's also a fixed point of a nonlinear diffusion equation where you take the time derivative and you change I to minus 1. And it's a diffusion equation with a Lyapunov functional, and you just integrate downhill. And if it's stationary, then that same solution is also stationary in Gross-Vitalski. So that works very nicely. He verified that it's stationary, this diffusion solution, stationary Gross-Vitalski. Yes, please.
One thing to check is to check the pattern formation literature to see whether this neural had worked on disclination dislocations in the...
That's right, in the analogous systems, right.
These things are disclinations and dislocations. Yeah.
Of course, it's complex. What else you would have?
I got a faster way, Everhart. Let's call Alan and ask him. Okay, now the other thing, though, that David verified is if you take the solution and perturb it a bit, that it, in fact, goes unstable and exponentially grows away from that connection, and here's then... The simulation of this perturbed fixed point, which reconnects repeatedly. So that was pretty good work for about 4 months of a first year graduate student, I thought. Oops.
That's like to form some homogenic cycle or something.
Depending on the box, it's possible. Okay, so we also computed then the eigenvector associated with the unstable, there are actually two unstable directions. but they're symmetry related. X goes to Y, and complex conjugate gives you the other unstable direction. So that eigenvalue or eigenvector has a shape. We've also measured the eigenvalue, which appears to depend somewhat on box size. The eigenvalue of this unstable satellite. Right, so we can perturb it, and we watch it exponentially grow in an L2 normal way from the fixed point and measure that growth rate. So the box size dependence on the eigenvalue is very sharp for small boxes. So these are in units of the coherence length. So if I have a 3-nanometer cube, you could potentially stabilize this fixed point in physically. But then the largest box sizes we could afford. Actually, this is the half box width, I should say. So this is, I think the largest simulation here is 128 by 128 by 128 coherence lengths. And it's okay. I can't say whether this settled down to its final value or not, but it's unstable for all the
supposed to saturate. What's interesting is this maximum, which is counterintuitive.
I don't have an explanation for that.
The box perturbs it.
It must be related to your distribution of V or something.
Funny you mentioned that. So this particular right angle crossing gives a fixed point. And actually, in particular then, it's unstable exponential growth, being linearly unstable fixed point. So in fact, this algebraic growth that is seen in these other reconnections is not the only thing that can happen. And I would say that this fixed point establishes there's more than one way that reconnection can occur. Okay, moreover, in these other calculations, it seems like at the moment of reconnection, the crossing angle is not 90 degrees locally. Although I think that's not something that's been systematically measured in the numerics, but it's surely allowed at the local linear level. Actually, at small scale, just in a Taylor series expansion sense, they have to be coplanar right when they cross. Even if in the far field they form a tent, okay? But they don't have to be at 90 degrees. And Dan Zirkle will make that clear already.
I think there's a difference between square root and exponent is that you get a square root when you really consider two vortices moving and then reconnecting. Or this plane hitting saddle point moving with a constant velocity. It translates this parabola. Now, when you consider things steady and perturbed a little bit, then you have exponential.
I agree with you entirely. So in fact, I think the picture is exactly what you said. Let me just rephrase it slightly. Mm-hmm. If this plane is moving linearly in time, you get a square root scissor out from the reconnection. If this plane is stuck and then exponentially grows, you don't get a square root scissor.
Yeah.
It's very slow.
You get exponent, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, but now one can consider what happens if you start out with these other angles. And actually, at the linear level, Nazarenko and West already identified that the prefactor in the square root depends on the angle. And so moreover, I would, as a hypothesis, say that the fact that we have different values of A may be interpretable as the fact that there are different geometries of reconnection that happen, and that there's at least a one-parameter family of reconnection events that are possible. Okay, it may be richer than that, but I think at least a one-parameter family that's possible, and this gives us hope that we can actually connect. If we know this function, well, Nazarenko and West give a candidate, but it's not the full nonlinear theory, then in fact I can relate our probability distribution of A to the probability distribution of the geometry that occurs through my favorite trick of transformation probabilities. Yeah?
Actually, the phi, it measures the distance to the homoclinical orbits. The homoclinical orbits is right hit on, and that would be the phi equal to pi over 2. But the unstandard ensemble orbits which has a different distance from it, and that's my explanation to the phi.
It's possible.
Actually helps too.
Right. So actually, in a broader context, understanding the geometry of phase space away from this fixed point could be very useful to understanding the whole process, and we have not yet headed down that direction. But there may be a lot of structure, in fact. Okay, so here's my gratuitous summary slide of fixed points of Sobieski. So the flat solution then is just a constant. It's coadmission zero. And actually, there's a nice paper by Michael Berry and M.R. Dennis talking about the general theory of the time evolution of singularities in complex systems. And so they lay out then the codimension, which tells you then that in some sense the geometry, how likely you are to see them. An n equal 1 vortex is line-like, and I guess in both of these cases the stability is well understood, that there are zero eigenvalues around this linear fixed point and then oscillatory phonons with a flat solution. For a long straight vortex, then there are probably all sorts of oscillatory solutions, some of them phonon-like, and some of them actually being vortical waves of different sorts. I suppose somebody's worked that out, but I'm unaware of the specific literature in it. So this n equal 2 vortex is kind of an interesting beast. It actually has a codimension 4, so that is likely to only ever happen at points in space. But in fact, it was widely regarded that an n equal 2 vortex is unstable. But I've yet to see anywhere where that was actually calculated. It seems to be posited on an energy grounds that two n equal 1s have a lower energy than one n equal 2. Okay, so here...
But that stays for us calculations.
You've done it.
No, I didn't. Okay. So
here's an n equal 2 vortex with a 1% perturbation put on it and then evolved in Gross-Fitievsky. Yeah, this diffusion solver allows us to find n equal 2 vortices.
I mean, while you're watching, I mean, in any of these pattern-forming systems that I know, there's only very few cases where you ever see an n equals 2 dislocation. And I mean, they're almost not in excitable
media. There are two classes of theory, unless I'm mistaken,
in dimension 4,
where the vortices want to be higher order or do not want to be higher order. Isn't that right, Nigel? What's the right terminology for that? It's the difference between type 1 and type 2 superconductors, as I have gathered.
Well, I'm talking about pattern formation, so not...
Well,
not
no, context, those, you know. It's related. Okay, in any case, it splits.
You're right. It does depend, for example, if you look at, say, the repeating Bose-Einstein condensates at high frequency, then it goes into the quantum Hall state machine, and you get one giant vortex in the middle. So if you want to...
They collapse into, yeah.
So if you want to think about that as being... That's where you can get a stable
right.
At high end.
So there are several distinct possibilities, I guess, which are interesting.
One exception.
Things it's very well easy. It's so, easy to prove it.
So I should fix my remark. In excitable media or complex Ginzburg-Landau type systems, usually the n equals 1 is the one that's there.
Yeah, yeah.
In relative inert convection, of course, we can have up to 13.
Right. Let's see, right, so this one has an unstable direction apparently, and of course these are always saddle pairs because the system is a symplectic structure, and probably also some oscillatory modes that we haven't looked at. Okay, so then there's this one that I showed you, this fixed point, we'll call it psi 2-2, so it's codimension 4, so actually this could occur in points in space-time, it's not, could happen accidentally or randomly, although definitely has a saddle, actually at least two pairs plus minus lambda directions that are related by symmetry. Haven't been able to find any more than two, but probably also oscillatory directions. And it turns out that it seems very likely that there's a psi 3-3. Okay, so I know this veers upon madness when you start looking at these things, but I think it's almost certain there's a nonlinear fixed point of Gross-Fitievsky that looks like that, that actually has, there are three different ways it can reconnect. For what it's worth, although we have not attempted to find it, in part because it's codimension 6, so it essentially would never happen in nature. It's extremely unlikely unless some contrivance to force it. All right, so just a couple more slides. So this is the thing that Eberhard and I have been bantering about by in person and by email in the last 24 hours. So one of the things that we found was that this separation, going like square root in time, has very specific implications for the velocity. So if I have a separation that goes like t minus t naught to the 1/2, and if you say, well, if that's the typical thing that happens in this state, well, what are the velocities doing? Well, we'll just take a time derivative, and the velocities then would go like t minus t naught to the minus 1/2. Okay? And I can compute the probability distribution of the velocities related to the uniform probability distribution of time and this Jacobian factor. Absolute dv dt. Now, this is easy to compute, and one immediately obtains, after two lines of whiteboard algebra, that the velocity distribution, if this is the typical thing that happens, should be like absolute 1 over v cubed. Okay, so, sorry.
It also says that if you have only kappa, out of kappa and v, you can make only kappa over v cubed dimensional.
That's right. But, in as much as though this has been established experimentally, this does involve abnormally high velocities, which implies this other thing. So there's a causal connection beyond dimensional analysis. Okay, so after doing the calculation, we went back and looked at the data, and lo and behold, this is the Vx and Vz components. The black line and red line here are 1 over v cubed tails. And in this decaying state, then, we have algebraic tails in the velocity distribution, rather than what you get in 3D turbulence, which tends to be Gaussian. And so at least in that way, quantum turbulence is very much unlike classical 3D turbulence. Okay, even though at large scale, they may be very similar with K to the minus 5/3 spectra in some cases. We're looking at some sense at small scale here, scale smaller than the inner vortex spacing. Things are very, very different and very interesting.
That's for, in the weather, that's for the old flow, and here you are not, you are just talking about the pre-connection events, I guess.
No. This is not a condition on any particle doing anything. It's for all particles, all velocities.
It is conditioned on the vortices, because you're only seeing the particles.
Incorrect. This is all particles, including the particles that are not in the vortices.
This is normal fluid too.
They're included here.
A lot of them with normal fluid.
This is every particle in the entire experiment without bias.
You're arguing that the particles are dragged into the vortex cores. You're arguing that the part of, outside the vortex cores, the superfluid goes around the particles.
Yes, sir.
Therefore, there is every single particle that's associated with a vortex core, and you're claiming that the particles tend to line, end up in vortex cores, excluding the normal fluid.
But you've seen the picture, these two sets of particles. One was moving up, that was the normal fluid. There were a lot of particles, you've
right.
seen it.
A large two number of particles are not trapped in vortices.
They were all normal fluid.
It's not sure.
It's one thing one has to realize here, there's a lot of normal fluid here.
Oh, yeah.
Lots
so
of
fact, this portion of the distribution, the most probable portion of the
of
distribution,
course,
are all of the normal
fluid.
Particles.
It's all normal fluid.
That's right.
Only tails are vortices.
That we know. Right.
Okay.
So the high probability, you know, this rounded part includes particles moving with a normal component, which are all doing something very mild-mannered
okay.
in these conditions. Right.
You could do a conditional sample on which direction they're going.
Okay, so all that data is when the counterflow is off. So the system is relaxing, and that would not work.
Ben, are you going to say something about our discussion now? Or are you?
I think this is a slide after this.
Okay, great. Now I just was asking, then I don't interrupt.
Okay, so there are a couple of interesting analogies, including the one that Eberhard's jumping up and down about back there.
Yes.
So one of the interesting analogies is with MHD turbulence, or I should actually say plasma reconnection in particular. One of the things that's been observed in the solar wind is that the probability distribution of energetic particles coming from the sun has power law tails. And it is widely thought that that is due in part due to reconnection of highly magnetized plasmas in the solar corona. Okay, so you all know that there was a coronal mass ejection on Valentine's Day? Actually, I think there were three, in fact. So, in fact, there is a very large collection of energetic particles heading toward the Earth right now, and the likelihood of a big geomagnetic storm today and tomorrow. So it's
from Valentine's Day to President's Day.
So you heard about this?
It's already
yeah.
started.
Has it? Okay. Well, last I checked, the Earth's magnetic field was still quiet. Okay. So magnetic reconnection, interestingly enough, is thought often to be dominated by Hall processes in the plasma, which give a dispersion relation, which is the same sort that Gross-Podievsky had. And allows very fast things to happen at small scale. This will make it goes like K-squared. So here's just to tease you, I've shown the probability distribution of the energy per unit mass of our particles, which also, of course, has power law tails as the velocities do. So the other connection that I became aware of yesterday is that...
I should mention this paper, this one in 2003, which had just the data without the... You know,
let me tell the story, Eberhard. Okay, so within Eberhard's group, they were studying pattern-forming systems, and in particular, the motion of defects in the pattern, and looking then at the velocities of these defects as they moved about in the experiment, and they found algebraic tails.
Dislocations.
So these are very, very much analogous to what we have in the helium, but in a very different physical medium, physical substrate. And also finding then probability distributions of velocity that are tantalizingly algebraic.
We know, we've measured it yet, but we know that these systems are all diffusive. Right. So they definitely should show the scalar block.
Yeah, right. Well, and I guess we were discussing the fact that in this case the diffusivity is giving square rooted time-like behavior close in time. We have this imaginary diffusivity in the Schrodinger equation that's doing it for us.
Eberhard is now part of the talk. I'll take a chairmanship of it myself at 1 minute 5 minutes.
Oh gosh, it should be much less than that.
So that's a power law tail too.
Eberhard, that's a question for you.
There's
a power law tail.
Well, it depends. You can look at the paper. It's within the. If you want to see a 3, you see a 3. If you want to see a 3.2, you see a 3.2.
Not quantums.
So it's not quantum three, it's always three.
Power poisoning.
We have one decade more than,
yes.
All right, last but not least, we see vortex rings. We can have heavily skeletonized rings that act a little unnaturally. If we go down to the very limit of very few particles, we tend to see pairs of particles that translate and collapse as the rings move and collapse. So, okay, so this is a bit dim, my apologies for that. But okay, so here you can see a pair that are zipping along and collapsing, which are very likely then to be particle pairs on rings. Rings are a common process, it turns out, in these flows, small scale rings. So Kayla Tooley, who's an undergraduate researcher now at graduate school at UCLA, just measured the rays as a function of time and axial position as a function of time and compared it to the existing phenomenological models. And it compares quite well to what was expected for collapsing vortex ring. So everybody always wants to hear about rotating
a quick question.
Vortices?
You have a big, very bright ones. You have a little tiny one. Well, what's all these big ones?
The particles are not monodisperse.
Oh.
The particles are polydisperse. That's a better sentence.
Oh. So it's not a big ring.
And in fact, the particle distribution is evolving in time as well.
Oh, okay.
Because when they collide, they probably stick irreversibly. Okay. So in fact, they tend to coarsen with time.
Oh.
And vortices. So Christie spent a very long time working to perfect then looking at the lattice of vortices. And that experiment turns out to be very, very hard because the lattice is very sensitive. So here's a case where we have an end-on view. The cryostat is rotating. Okay, I think this highlights the particles. So we do not have a very regular triangular lattice, but we do have some order in the system. If we look at the autocorrelation function, you can see a faint ring around, which has the spacing that you would expect for the rotation rate we were at. But not a quiet, subtle triangular lattice, which is the lowest energy state. So let me actually show you what the movie looks like. So, and in part, we have our lattice has waves on it. And what I've come to understand is the triangular lattice and the square lattice are very close to each other energy-wise, so even a little bit of motion will tend to disorder the lattice. But these waves are ever-present when attempting these experiments. And I might note that, in part, we're using the entire container here, which is 5 centimeters in diameter, and a lot of the historical experiments tend to confine themselves to small volumes with relatively few vortices. Although these collective modes may well be being driven by the Earth's rotation. So there are links to reprints and preprints at complex.umd.edu. And I guess it started out with this short Nature paper by Greg Bewley. And I guess the velocity statistics are in this paper, PRL from 2008. And I just wanted to, in the end, since I'm here for, so what is quantum turbulence? Reconnection and ring collapse. Okay, I would say, in my view, are the dominant mechanisms. But flying out here, I wrote down a list of questions that trouble yours truly. So since we still have a few days to talk, here are a few things that if anybody wants to talk about. So how many types of reconnection are possible? I think I've already raised this issue.
You put it on Wiki?
No. Should
please,
I?
Please do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do terminal hydrodynamic shear flows always couple into high Q wave modes, which is not what I talked about today, but I have many examples for those that are interested in that. Should hydrodynamics engage more with astrophysicists or geophysicists or cosmology researchers? That's something interesting to think about.
It's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, that's right. Why do particle-laden turbulent flows often lead to large electric fields, I think is an interesting question, bearing on a number of natural processes like volcanic eruptions and sandstorms and cumulonimbus clouds, among others. So what role does reconnection play in Navier-Stokes hydrodynamics? And Bob, maybe you and I can talk later about that some. And finally, we've talked a lot this week about turbulent boundary layers, but I guess all of my experiments rotate, essentially, and so I have rapidly rotating turbulent boundary layers, and thereby turbulent Ekman layers, and I think it's interesting to think about how log layers are modified in the presence of strong rotation. And this is the naturally occurring case. If you look at the Earth's atmosphere or the Earth's core, you know, any planetary situation, that's what you're going to have. So it's actually much more common than one might imagine. That's it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.